This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You take a company like, I don't know, Bentley or Lamborghini or one of those. When they come out with an SUV, no matter how crazy it is for their brand concept, it invariably becomes their best-selling vehicle. And automakers recognize that.
According to the International Energy Agency, over 14 million electric vehicles, or EVs, are expected to be sold globally in 2023. If this is accurate, EVs would account for about 18% of total car sales for the year, a 35% increase over 2022. The EV revolution is upon us, and here to help Sea Change Radio listeners decide where to plug in is automotive journalist Jim Motovalli. We discuss the puzzling decision by General Motors to shelve the Chevy Bolt, get some recommendations on new EV automakers and models, and examine America's ongoing fascination with big old gas-guzzling trucks and SUVs. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jim Motovalli. He is a freelance automotive journalist. He contributes to publications such as the New York Times, Barron's, Auto Week, TechCrunch. Jim, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be on Sea Change Radio.
So we haven't had you on for a couple of years, but I wanted to dive into some of the evolution of the electric vehicle, the EV space with you. Last time we talked, Tesla was riding high. It was by far and away the biggest player in the space. But you were talking about some of these newer names like Rivian coming around to compete with the Teslas in the higher range. Why don't you first give us a progress report on some of these non-Tesla brands and how they stack up to the Teslas of the world?
Well, there's two things happening. One is all the mainstream automakers are introducing EVs, and those are hitting the market. And there are also the startups, and those include Rivian and Lucid, have gotten cars on the road, and they're starting to show up in dealerships and compete with Tesla. None of them have vehicles in sufficient quantities yet to challenge Tesla in the marketplace. I mean, Tesla is still by far the largest seller in the EV market. But I think in terms of quality and appeal, I think we're now seeing vehicles that rival Tesla. So their absolute and total dominance is kind of threatened by all these startups. There's companies like Bollinger that have launched and then gotten out of the market. Sono Motors was another one. I mean, there's several EV companies that have not made it, but I think at this point we can say that Rivian and Lucid are probably going to go the distance and have very credible vehicles. And I was just on a week-long ride and drive event with Lucid, and their cars are very, very impressive. But, you know, they're a startup, so you sort of have the, you know, the teething problems of a startup. They still haven't gotten their production in line with what they want it to be. I mean, still hard to get them.
Yes. How are numbers stacking up overall in terms of what experts were predicting 5 years ago in terms of the EV market share versus what it is today? When we're talking about production numbers, we're still far away from making that complete transition to an electric fleet, that's for sure. But why don't you give us an idea of kind of the dent that they've made?
EVs are something like 7% of the U.S. auto market right now. It's probably double that in California, which is the largest U.S. EV market. And I was just down in Florida. I couldn't believe how many EVs are on the road there. You wouldn't expect it. And I was in the Miami area, and there are so many Teslas on the road there. And I saw EVs of every stripe, even some that fairly rare, like the, you know, the Mercedes EQS, and I even saw a Bollinger on the road down there. And I did find a fairly good availability of EV charging. We went to a national park, and you could charge your EV there. So there are pockets of strong EV sales in the country, the Northeast, the West, Florida, and Texas are all very good EV markets. But like I said, it's still less than 10% of sales. However, just about every automaker is going to stop making internal combustion vehicles by 2035 at the latest. So then it's not a question of, well, should I buy an internal combustion car or an EV? There won't be any gas cars or diesel cars on the road.
Well, they'll be on the road, but they won't be getting sold.
Yeah, well, they won't be available to buy except as used cars. And you know, there won't be any new internal combustion engines, and a number of states, as well as Europe as a whole, the European Union, have said no electric or no gas car sales after 2035. California then joined that, and New York and a number of other states are now on board with that. So you would not be able to buy gas cars, new gas cars, in a number of states by 2035, or all of Europe, or you know, significant parts of the other rest of the world. I think probably China is not going to be selling gas cars either.
So what's driving this transformation? Is it policy? Is it the market?
I think it's the market in the sense that the vehicles are going to be better than the gas cars. The electric vehicles have many advantages, including in terms of what, say, Car and Driver and Motor Trend and Road and Track care about, which is performance. It's the electric cars that can go 0 to 60 in 1.9 seconds. It's the Tesla Model S Plaid Edition. It's the Lucid Air Sapphire Edition. It's the there's at least a couple other ones. The electric motor has 100% torque at 0 RPM, so it just takes off from a standing start. It's incredibly fast that way. And I think when the Tesla Model S came out, suddenly it became an independent object of desire. People said, I want one of those. They weren't thinking, oh, I got to be green, I got to eat the spinach or whatever. They said, this is actually cool. This is something I want. That had to happen before I think EVs could take off. But now, to me, the supercar is dead in internal combustion form. There's no reason to buy a V12 supercar when an electric one can outperform it and operate incredibly cheaper.
So, Jim, the Chevy Bolt was General Motors' best-selling electric vehicle. They delivered 20,000 EVs in the US in the last quarter, and it's had some problems along the way, some bumps and some very expensive recalls, but they just announced that they're shutting down the brand. What should people who are following the EV space make of this?
Well, General Motors may be killing the Bolt, but they're doubling down on EVs. See, the reality of the market is that 80% of the market wants to buy SUVs. So pretty much all the vehicles that are on the drawing board, you take a company like, I don't know, Bentley or Lamborghini or one of those. When they come out with an SUV, no matter how crazy it is for their brand concept, it invariably becomes their best-selling vehicle. And automakers recognize that. You know, the popularity of small hatchbacks has been waning for a long time. It's like 5% of the market or something. So the Bolt is a small car, and I think that's pretty much why they killed it. But they're not giving up on EVs just because they're getting rid of that. They killed the Volt also, their plug-in hybrid, which was also very pioneering. But you know, I think some of the things that GM has done, some of the vehicles I just don't understand, like the Hummer EV, the pickup and SUV versions of those, how big a battery you have to put in those things and how heavy the vehicles get. But the Hummer EV weighs 9,600 pounds. And yeah, it's really fast, and I'm sure it can go off-road and all that, but it's just, I think that's the wrong way to go. We should make EVs as light as possible, so they need the fewest amount of battery.
Yes, I heard a stat that said that one Rivian uses as much batteries as 4,500 e-bikes. So that's like 4,500 people that could get around a city very easily on their e-bike, but somebody has to have one truck that goes super fast.
Yeah, I mean, I like everything I've seen of Rivian. I like what the company does. It's just their vehicles are not in my demographic. I don't really want to own a big, heavy pickup truck or off-roading SUV. It's just not, I don't care about that. I'll tell you why. Please tell me why. Every woman I know is crazy by automobile. Every woman I know is crazy by automobile. And yeah, I am standing with nothing but rubber heels.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to automobile expert Jim Motovalli. So, Jim, let's dive into what's behind this fascination that American drivers have with large cars. It's not a global fascination, is it? This is uniquely American, wanting to have these big SUVs. I know that there are bigger cars elsewhere, but there's no other country that has this percentage of its fleet being large scale trucks and SUVs. Is there another country like this?
I would say not. But, you know, fuel in the U.S. is cheaper than it is just about anywhere else in the world, except maybe in Saudi Arabia. I think it's pretty cheap there.
But it's more than that. It was like, what, 30 years of marketing, right? This Chevy like a rock and Ford F-150s, tough, and all these marketing things that just have been battering us for decades, and it's effective.
Well, let me make a point here, Alex. Maybe it's contrary to the trend you're talking about. If you go back to the start of the SUV craze, it was when Jeep started selling a lot of Cherokees and Wranglers and stuff. And the Jeep brand at that point was at a fairly low ebb. And at one point it was owned by Renault, the French company. And they sold it to Chrysler. It was part of AMC also. And the Renault sold AMC, including, you know, American Motors and Jeep, to Chrysler. And it wasn't even that expensive. And the main thing Chrysler wanted was this plant in Canada that was state of the art, came with a deal. They didn't regard the Jeep brand as any sort of great prize because it wasn't selling that much.
They wanted the AMC Pacer, huh?
Pretty much. No, I don't think they wanted the Pacer either. But anyway, they didn't pay that much for it. So they ended up with Jeep. And then they noticed that people were starting to buy four-wheel drive vehicles. The companies started to notice that and they started to encourage it. But I'm saying the trend to buying these off-road vehicles and sort of as an image thing, I think it was actually initiated by consumers rather than by a marketing push, though it was immediately capitalized on and expanded by the marketing people. And it feeds into some sort of desire on the part of Americans to feel like they're adventurous, they're different from the herd, and you know they can go off-road. It's nonsense because only like 10% of SUVs ever leave the road anyway, but it's the potential, it's the idea.
So getting back to the Chevy Bolt and its demise, let's focus on the manufacturing side of things and getting away from the marketing angle. I heard that there's economies of scale to be gained by switching over to this new type of production facility that'll allow them to crank out lots of SUVs and trucks. But if GM was having trouble with the Bolt in terms of some recalls that they had, that's a light car. One would think that that's an easier car to build more precisely. Why then take this leap into much heavier, more difficult to maintain and to build vehicles, besides the fact that they're very inefficient and not as good for the environment, yes, they're not using gas, but they're using a ton of lithium ion batteries.
GM has made some moves that I don't understand at all. If you take, let's go back to the launch of the Prius, the Toyota Prius. That was launched in Japan in 1996 and the U.S. in 2000. And the American companies had just taken part in this thing called Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles, or PNGV. And that program, which is a federal program, encouraged them to develop hybrid cars that would get, I think it was 60 miles per gallon was the target. And all three of the automakers developed 60 mile per gallon hybrid cars in probably around 1998, I think it was. They weren't obligated to market them, and none of them did, but they did develop them. So meanwhile, the Prius shows up in the U.S. in 2000. It's an immediate hit, and no American automaker comes up with any kind of alternative to it until 2004, when Ford introduced the Escape Hybrid. And GM, in its wisdom, decides that, well, you know, our Silverado pickup is really popular. Why don't we make a hybrid version of that? So they come out with this hybrid Silverado that gets 19 miles per gallon compared to 17 for the regular one. Where was the incentive to buy that thing? And this is when the, I don't remember what the Prius's fuel economy was at the beginning, but it was probably about 40, 45 miles per gallon. And it was also a lot cheaper than that Silverado. So when they come out with electric versions of the Hummer or hybrid versions of the Silverado, I don't get it.
And there's new management in place at some of these big automakers, and their missteps over the last few decades are well chronicled. And it's one of the reasons why Tesla's market cap is bigger than the big three U.S. automakers combined. They missed a huge opportunity. But it looks like they're doubling down in some ways. They're just like, well, this is what we know. We know SUVs and trucks, and that's what we're going to do. And so what? We're not going to refine this small Bolt, which I know I keep going back to it, but it was the most cost-effective electric vehicle on the market. And it was an important niche that GM had started carving out. And to abandon it, I think it's a big misstep by General Motors, and they'll look back on it with regret.
Well, you may recall that Elon Musk I think his goal was for the Model 3 was like $35,000. And I think the Bolt got to market before he did at a very good price point. So it was a big goad on Tesla to keep the price down on the Model 3. And I don't think you can really buy one for $35,000, but it is the cheapest Tesla. And yes, you're right. The Bolt was a revelation when it came out because it had really decent range and it was reasonably priced. And I think that was an important milestone. So I applaud the Bolt. Plus, it was really fun to drive.
My sister-in-law has one and I've driven in it and it's a terrific car. I mean, the range that she had on hers, I think, was the first iteration. It was like 180 miles, but that's expanded. And a lot of these cars are starting to regularly exceed 300 miles in range, right?
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, I mentioned that Lucid trip I was just on, and they have a model called the Grand Touring version of the Air that has 516 miles of range, certified by the EPA.
Wow.
Now, that is a lot of range. So, you know, there's so many great EVs. If I was buying an EV now, I might look at the latest models from Hyundai or Kia, because I think those offer the most bang for the buck. I think they're got really good range. The prices are very reasonable. They're really nicely styled. They have crisp, beautiful interiors. I think that's probably where I would buy a car now if I was buying an EV. I just think the Koreans are doing terrific stuff with EVs right now.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to automobile expert Jim Motovalli. So, Jim, we were just talking about the increased range in electric vehicles. Can you give us an update on where things stand in the charging department? How is our network going to alleviate what's known as range anxiety moving forward?
Well, there's a few things happening there. People still do have range anxiety. I think there's like 9,500 EV charging stations, and the station has numerous charging points. So there's two ways of looking at it. The last I looked at was around 9,500. However, the Tesla supercharger network, and one of the big selling points of Tesla has been that they have their own network. And it's really very robust and across the whole country, and it doesn't go down a whole lot. It's very robust. They have just opened that to non-Teslas, which I think is very important to do. A problem has been that aside from Tesla, the other companies operating charging stations have not been best at what they call keeping them operational. So people will turn up at EV charging stations and find them out of order. And that's very discouraging, and it could be quite alarming if you're running out of charge. And part of the Biden mandate in the Inflation Reduction Act in terms of assistance to charging stations is that they operate, that they're operating 96% of the time. I think that's a very important rule to have out there. It's a big incentive to do maintenance and make sure that your EV stations are operating. And that's been a problem.
And Tesla has these supercharging stations. Why don't you give us an overview of how the time to charge has transformed over the last few years?
Well, these are 480-volt charging stations. And depending on how your car is set up, and the rating of the station, you're probably able to go from a 20 to 80% state of charge in about 20 minutes.
How does that differ from 5 years ago, let's say?
Well, 5 years ago, we probably would not have even had a 480-volt charging network. So the initial EV stations were 240-volt, what they call level two. And like if you were to take some of these big batteries and something like the Lucid Air or the Hummer EV, we're talking, maybe 15 hours to charge on a level two station. So it's very important we get to 480 volts and fast charging. This is direct current or DC fast charging. That is not something you're going to have in your home. If you have a charger at home, it's going to be a level two, 240 volt charging, because you can only get 240 volts in your house. You can't get 480. So the fast charging is external to where you live. But for most people, you bring the car home at, say, 6 o'clock, you plug it in, it's definitely going to be ready to go by the time you leave in the morning. So that hasn't been a problem. And you can also set the car so that it charges only when the rates go down, if you have a utility that has that kind of structure.
And which is the bigger variability in the charge? Is it the car itself or the charging station?
I would say it's both combined. And some of the new EVs are capable of charging at a very, very fast rate. And they're using that as a selling point.
About how fast?
I haven't heard anyone say they're charging at a rate that'll get you any faster than maybe 10 minutes.
Still, that's pretty fast.
Yeah, 10 minutes is about the best you're going to do right now, I would say.
So we were talking about the American consumer's fascination with large trucks and SUVs and how that relates to the EV market. Why don't you compare that to how things are unfolding in Europe, Jim?
Well, I've made several trips to Europe recently, and it's sad to say, but Europe has basically followed the U.S. in adopting the SUV, though not in as great numbers, not nearly as high a percentage And I would say their rate of EV adoption is higher than the US, so not hugely so. Maybe they're at 15% EV adoption. It's not, at the rate that's going to seem like a revolution in what's on the road. You still see mostly gas cars everywhere, but the projections, and Europe has that 2035 deadline for no longer selling gas cars. It's expensive to buy fuel in Europe because it's so heavily taxed.
And I imagine, even though the car buying patterns are changing in terms of the makeup, they're getting larger, just like the US, the European consumer is starting to salivate over bigger cars. The average European household is owning less cars than they did 2 decades ago, I imagine.
Well, Europe has very good public transit for the most part, and people don't drive as much as they do in the US because it's more expensive to own a car and to use it. But I should point out that in some parts of Europe, the EV adoption is off the charts, specifically Norway, which last I heard had something like 85 to 90% of all new car purchases being electric. That's the best in the world, and it's because of very good financial incentives. Norway is not the best place in the world to operate an SUV or an electric car because it's very cold there, and EVs don't do great in the cold. But government policies have really shaped that market there.
And it's a wealthy country where the consumers can afford expensive trucks.
Yeah. So I think Norway is showing the world the direction it's going to go. I mean, if you ask me, do I have any doubt that the whole auto fleet is going to go electric? I would say zero. I have zero doubt about that. In fact, I predicted that in the book I wrote, Forward Drive, that came out in the year 2000. And there weren't even any EVs on the road then. I just said, that's what's going to happen. Everyone's going to be driving electric cars. And lo and behold,
Well, we appreciate your time, and your foresight is always right on the money, Jim Motovalli. Jim, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
you bet, Alex, anytime.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to SeaChange Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Galactic, Ry Cooter, and Junior Walker and the All-Stars. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to SeaChange Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. SeaChange Radio,